Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 178 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or don't. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth, and that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges to others. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to friends. Some feedback on the remembrance of Michael Elner, episode 177. Raphael wrote, "Thank you for the fine show of remembrance for Michael Elner. It was a very special moment. I had listened to another show elsewhere where Michael had been mentioned in passing, and I was left feeling that so much more could have been done to honor such a remarkable server of humanity. I'm not a listener to your show, but yesterday an unexpected change in my itinerary found me with a free hour or so. For some reason, I felt moved to dial up PRN.fm at the top of the hour, no less. Holy kapow, Michael was one of my heroes. Sincerely, thank you." Laurent on Facebook just said, "I really enjoyed this show." After the show, Celia Farber wrote to me and the other guests, indicating some discomfort with Michael Elner's position on circumcision, which was rather harsh towards those, including fellow Jews, who circumcised their children. I don't want to describe the entire conversation because parts were personal, but the discussion illustrated the difficulty of making a decision in the face of a desire to respect traditions, pressures from family and friends, conflicting scientific knowledge, and various proposed benefits and harms. A lot of decisions we make in life are like that, and I think the discussion and information are important for being able to make the best possible decision. And now let's get to this week's guest. Emily Tarcell's daughter Christina died suddenly in her sleep the night of June 23rd, 2008. Days after receiving the Gardasil HPV vaccine. The family believe her death was due to HPV, but they discovered they could not sue the drug company Merck for the death because it was a vaccine. So they went to the so-called U.S. vaccine court, and after an 8-year battle, they won. The U.S. government conceded that they had met the burden of proof that Gardasil caused the death of Christina. Emily, Christina's mother, runs the website Gardasil and unexplainedeaths.com, and don't worry about the spelling, we'll put it in the show notes. Welcome to the show, Emily, and my condolences on the death of your daughter.
Thank you so much, David.
I'll start by reading something you put on your website. "Hi, my name is Christina Rochelle Tarcell, but people call me Chris. I celebrated my 21st birthday in November 2007. I did not live to see my 22nd. Suddenly and inexplicably, I died in bed in June 2008. An autopsy report said that the cause of my death was undetermined. My family wanted to know what happened to me, and led by attorney Mark Sadaka, they pursued an extensive investigation. World-class experts in immunology, Dr. Yehuda Schoenfeld, and cardiology and electrophysiology, Dr. Michael Elder, determined that I died from an arrhythmia induced by an autoimmune response to the HPV vaccine Gardasil, which I had received only days before my death. Incredibly, by law, vaccine manufacturers like Merck cannot be held liable for injuries and deaths caused by the vaccines. The only recourse my family had was to file a claim against the Secretary of Health and Human Services to hold them accountable. After 8 long years, the government finally conceded that we met our burden of proof that Gardasil caused my death. This is a precedent-setting case. I'm deeply grateful to everyone who, guided by truth and a higher consciousness, would not let my death be dismissed as a coincidence. And you provide links to the ruling by Judge Coster Williams and the revised ruling by the special master. So 8 years is a long time, and I'm sure there were lots of ups and downs, but can you describe the process that you had to go through over this 8 years at kind of a high level?
Well, the beginning of it was an autopsy. And at the time she died, no one knew what happened. And at that time, I did not associate it with the vaccine at all. And the autopsy report came back, cause of death undetermined. Now, this was after her third inoculation, because Gardasil is 3 shots.
Mm-hmm.
And this is 18 days after the third shot.
Right.
So in terms of finding out what happened, it was a slow process. It was a process of finding out that other girls were reported to have had sudden unexplained deaths.
Mm-hmm. After Gardasil.
After Gardasil, right. And so we were connecting on the web and by email, and as I heard about other cases, I became suspicious that it was the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
We collectively were searching for how this could have happened. As well as, you know, lots of other girls who were having injuries reported. So we thought maybe there could be a class action. And we contacted various attorneys, and we found out you can't do a class action for a vaccine injury or death.
Right, you can't sue the drug companies, and I guess class actions against the government are not possible?
Right. Each case has to be considered on its own. And in some ways, I understand that because there can be different presentations of symptoms, and different outcomes. So you can't do a class action. And so it was at that point also that, as you say, I realized, and no one had told us prior to that, that you cannot sue the pharmaceutical company and that they're protected by law since 1986 for any, they have no liability. So
just for vaccines. I mean, if this had been a drug, you could have easily sued the pharmaceutical company.
Yes, you can sue for drugs and not for vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were granted by the government, by law, they were granted protection from liability, the government established the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which was meant to be originally not adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the petitioner. And if you could establish, there were 3 prongs that you had to satisfy in order to receive an award. And if you could meet those 3 requirements, the compensation was to be expedited and was allegedly supposed to be generous.
Mm-hmm.
None of those things are true, as I found out in the process. So we first got an attorney, and the attorney has to be somebody who knows the system, because the vaccine compensation program, or vaccine injury compensation program, is not like civil court.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do discovery. You don't have a trial by jury. It's more like an administrative hearing, and so you have to go through an administrative process. And you have to have an attorney who knows that system.
Yes, sounds highly specialized, and as you said, it's a very obscure court that most parents don't even know exists, even after vaccine damage happens sometimes.
Right, that's true. And there's also a statute of limitations. So by the time someone might realize their child was vaccine injured or they were vaccine injured, the statute of limitations might have expired. There are many hurdles to jump through. And my attorney led me through those.
Right.
One of the most important is the three prongs that you have to be able to satisfy: a temporal relationship between the injury or the death and vaccination.
So a relatively short time between the time of vaccination and the time of injury or death.
Right. You have to be able to show a medically plausible explanation of how this could have happened. So, in other words, you have to describe the mechanism by which this injury could have been caused by the vaccine. And that is quite a hurdle.
Right.
And the third thing is you have to show a logical sequence of events. So I will say also that many families, even if they do apply, they can be kicked out, so to speak. Your case is dismissed. For example, if you've gotten a concurrent vaccination, if you got a vaccination of Gardasil and something else at the same time, then it becomes difficult. It would become difficult to prove that it was Gardasil.
So, let me get this straight. So if you have vaccine A and B, so they can't, and they could say, well, one of those two vaccines caused the damage, but we don't know if it was A or B, therefore you don't get compensated?
Well, it gets more complicated to narrow it down. Also, if you are on a medication,
mm-hmm.
or some girls may have been on a birth control pill.
Right.
All of those make it extremely difficult to get anywhere in the vaccine court. So it complicates the case. And I can't say that it's never happened, that someone has succeeded in narrowing it down, but I don't know of a case that has.
So I assume what you're basically implying is that in the case of Christina, she didn't have any of those other things. Like, there was no other vaccine, no drugs, no birth control pill in her case that allowed some clarity?
Right. Yeah. I know of a case, for example, where they... Well, I won't go into that, but yes, you're correct. So we didn't have a confounding condition in her case. Nevertheless, it's extremely hard to tweak out a mechanism by which a vaccine could, in this case Gardasil, could have caused her death.
Maybe we should step back a little bit and talk about what happened to Christina. What I read from the final report was that there were no effects after the first vaccine dose. After the second, she started to have an irregular heartbeat. After the third, she developed some spots by her ear. She started to get dizzy and faint. And that third dose was on June 3rd, 2008, and her death was on June 21st or 23rd. I thought I said 23rd somewhere else. But is that basically, are there other medical things that happened after the second or third dose?
Well, basically that is what happened. She, establishing when the arrhythmia started was very important to the case.
Mm-hmm.
And the special master tried to make it seem that she may have had an arrhythmia prior to vaccination. But years and years of medical records indicated that she had no prior reports of arrhythmia.
Yeah, there was actually quite a large number. I guess she had regularly gone for checkups, and they had checked her heartbeat at everyone and noted total normality over tens of checkups.
Yeah, something like 60 incidences. And
right.
She was an athlete, so of course they needed to always have medical clearance for
mm-hmm.
Athletic participation. And yeah, so it never been picked up. So she got the shot in August 2007. She was away at college, so I don't really know if she was, you know, experiencing anything. She didn't complain of anything at that time. She came out for Thanksgiving break, and it happened that I had an appointment with her, with my physician, to switch her from a pediatrician to an adult primary caretaker.
Because she was 21 at this time, right?
Right. She was 20.
Okay.
No, she was 21.
Okay. I guess that doesn't really matter, but she was an adult at this point.
Right. And so that is how we first learned of the arrhythmia. Now, this was several months. This was in November, and so this is a few months after she had the first shot. And the doctor picked up an arrhythmia, and we were like, really? So they said, well, it could be a false positive, and she should get checked again at Christmas, when she comes home for the Christmas break. And it was also the day she got her second shot.
So she actually had the arrhythmia before the second shot?
Yes, but
okay.
After the first shot.
Okay, yep.
And so she got that second shot the same day, and then we went back in December, and the same pattern of arrhythmia occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, and she was also having some nasal congestion, and we saw an ENT, and he said there was nothing structurally wrong. So he said maybe she's allergic to something. So the doctor suggested that she get an EKG,
mm-hmm.
an echocardiogram, which she did when she went back to college, and that came back normal. Now, the problem is, and we did not know it then, that the doctor had misread the kind of arrhythmia that she was having,
mm-hmm.
and she should have been instead put on a Holter monitor, but instead she was given this echocardiogram, which revealed no structural difficulties.
Right.
But in retrospect, it was electrical, not structural.
Okay.
And so had she gotten a different test, we may have seen a different result. But since that came back normal, we thought everything was okay.
But isn't it also true that people with arrhythmia don't, like I think it was quoted somewhere that 17% of the time, like people with arrhythmia will have it only a fraction of the time, not necessarily 100% of the time.
Right, which is why you wear a Holter monitor,
mm-hmm.
because you're wearing that 24.
Oh, I see. So it wouldn't just be you go to the doctor and then over a period of 5 minutes your heart's measured, but it would be over a longer period of time.
Right, right. And that's the test you should have had.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, during the echocardiogram, you know, that result came back normal, and so the doctor wasn't recommending any follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
We all assumed everything's okay. She was away at college, and I didn't see her again because I was away. And I usually would visit her during the spring, but I was away. So I didn't see her until the end of May,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the semester. And her dad took her for her third shot of Gardasil.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even realize she had gotten that, but she picked me up at the airport, and she was complaining. This is 3 days after the shot.
Mm-hmm.
She was complaining of feeling dizzy when she would stand up. She had a rash, and she complained of feeling very, very tired.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had no, you know, this seemed like, well, maybe you're overworked yourself this semester.
Yeah, I can see.
And all that.
Right? I can see thinking that, yes.
Yeah. So, but I was concerned, and I knew I would be seeing her in a couple of weeks. She had a job on campus for the summer, so she wanted to get back to school, and she had also just found off-campus housing with some peers, and I knew I'd be seeing her in a couple of weeks, and I wanted to follow up on the symptoms she was talking about when I went to see her. I really wanted her to stay home longer from her break,
right.
between the semester, but she was very responsible and she wanted to be available for orientation. And so I gave her a car. She had a car for the first time. And I expected to see her in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But before that transpired, I got a knock on the door. It was the police, and they came to tell me they had found her dead.
Wow, so it wasn't even at home, not that
no.
I would
she
make
was
it any better.
At college. At first, you know, you're in denial, and I just couldn't believe. I thought they had the wrong person, and you go through all of that. And
right, right. You definitely do not want to hear that your child died mysteriously, or died of any, you know, any kind of situation, accident or whatever.
Right, right, right. And, you know, so I was just in shock and do what people do and deny and
mm-hmm.
cry and pace and scream and tell them they've got the wrong house.
Right.
You know. And so, okay, when it sunk in that this was true, then we had to go get her remains. And the thing is, they hadn't found her for 3 days.
Oh.
She had a, they, like I said, they had moved off campus. To some housing that and her roommates and she had just moved in, and it was over the weekend they thought she had gone down to New York because she used to go down there. She had done an internship down there, and when she didn't answer her cell phone, they thought maybe her battery had died.
Right.
So there was this period of a few days when a number of us were calling her and weren't getting a response. And it wasn't until Monday after the weekend, when she didn't show up for work, that her roommates went into her room and found her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so since she had been deceased for a few days, and we don't know exactly the time of death, and so there's some confusion in the reports of when she died, the 21st, the 23rd, we don't know exactly.
Oh, I see. I mean, it's logically seems more likely that it was earlier in that time period, because otherwise they probably would have seen her going in and out of her room.
Right.
But that's not proof.
Right.
Yeah.
And that also precluded certain tests that, you know, we might have done post-mortem, but... since she had had those incidences of arrhythmia earlier, I asked the pathologist to pay special attention to her heart. And so they spent an extra couple of months doing the autopsy and called in some experts, and they could not find anything structurally that would have accounted for that.
Right, and of course, any electrical anomalies cease with her death, so there would
exactly.
be no way to exactly. find anything there.
Right. So...
But they... I hope I'm not jumping forward too much, but it was eventually concluded that she died of an arrhythmia. Was that just basically a logical... inference, or was there any evidence for that? You know, any physical evidence?
Yes. That's where the experts came in. The electrophysiologist, cardiologist, Dr. Eldar, and Dr. Schoenfeld in terms of immunology. And so there were papers published regarding... molecular mimicry, and the fact that the L1 gene protein in the vaccine has a structure similar to that which regulates the calcium channel in the heart.
Okay, so that's a pretty complicated point that you just laid on us. Okay, so there is a protein in the HPV vaccine that's presumably related to getting an immune response or something, and there is a similar protein related to the calcium channel, and it says somewhere in the report that increased amounts of intracellular calcium can lead to arrhythmia.
Right. Now, she had other symptoms that would suggest she was having an autoimmune response, like the rash, the arrhythmia, the fatigue also.
Right.
So the relation and the relationship then between something in the vaccine that could cause an irregular heartbeat, because the calcium channel regulates the rhythm of the heart.
Right.
And also, you know, it gets quite technical, but the experts established those connections.
Right.
So, so hers then was the first case where the government conceded that the vaccine, the preponderant evidence was that the vaccine caused her death.
But they didn't do this without a fight. Like, from the final ruling of the special master, Christian Moran, he wrote, "The undersigned previously found that Ms. Tarsell had not met her burden of proof. However, the Court of Federal Claims vacated the decision and remanded for additional consideration under different legal standards. And under the court-directed legal standards, the undersigned finds that Ms. Tarsell is entitled to compensation. I mean, that sounds like that would have been a pretty major disruption in the process of the case, I guess, accounting for part of the 8 years that it took.
Right. Part of the 8 years, I mean, you have to go through a lot of hoops, and, you know, they, like I said, they try to eliminate cases, you know, first just reviewing the medical record in general and seeing if there are other complications and looking at your evidence. So there are a number of steps along the way. When you finally do get a hearing, you know, we filed in 2010. I think our hearing was in 2014, so it was four years.
Right.
Before we even had a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they want certain reports, and they might ask for clarifications and, you know, more published papers in support of your hypothesis. And so it takes a really long time. When we finally got to after the hearing, it took almost a year for the special master to make a decision.
Which was negative.
And it was negative. He was saying, well, you haven't proven that she had the arrhythmias. She didn't, you know, she may have had the arrhythmias before the vaccine. And then if that piece doesn't hold, then you can't, you know, we can't concede the other arguments. And then they also tried to attack the explanation.
Like the logical explanation regarding the molecular mimicry, the calcium channel, et cetera.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I will say that the government had no alternative explanation.
I was going to ask you that, because I've read many times that, you know, just because a death occurs or an injury occurs a few days or a few weeks after vaccination, that's not proof that the vaccine caused it. But I think people don't very often ask, like, okay, so what's your alternative rational explanation for why a previously healthy young person suddenly suffers severe symptoms or death after a vaccination? There has to be, you know, really, they need to give an alternative theory, I think, before you can rationally conclude that the vaccine was not responsible.
You would think, but they don't. They don't have to. And they didn't. They didn't have an explanation for her death. And their argument was based mostly on the fact that they'll say something like 80 million shots have been given, and, you know, the safety profile's excellent, whatever. But they don't actually investigate, which is something amazing to me. If this were, a car accident, brake failures in a certain vehicle, something like that, there would be an investigation. And if the manufacturer had done something that contributed to the death, you know, that would be investigated. I called and reported Chris's death.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't investigate. Nor did they investigate the cases of the other moms that I know about who reported.
When you say you called, who did you call?
You can make a report to the vaccine, to the VAERS system.
V-A-E-R-S, right.
Yes. Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is completely separate from the court.
Yes. But it's still... it's still under the purvey of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, that they would, like, send out a team and that they would have questions and that all they did was they did ask for her medical records.
Mm-hmm.
They did a test to rule out a streptococcus.
Yeah.
Which she didn't have. And that was pretty much, and they had, their decision was cause of death unexplained. They did no further investigation. And it was that point that I realized it's all on the family. If you've got a vaccine injury or death, it's totally up to you. The government's not going to do a thing to help you find out what happened.
It seems stacked against you. Like, I mean, an 8-year court process is a huge burden, and I'm sure there's lots of families that would give up, you know, at the first hurdle, just because they don't have the time, they can't afford it. I mean, what kinds of costs were you bearing during this process?
Well, the one positive thing about the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is they pay for the attorney.
They pay for your attorney.
They pay for the government's attorney who are fighting you. They pay for your attorney.
Okay.
So, so that made it possible financially, although I know parents in other countries, different countries allow different things.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, you can sue the doctor.
Right.
You can't in America. In Canada, you can sue the pharmaceutical company. I know a family who attempted that, but once the expenses got over $50,000, they couldn't afford to hang in there. So,
yes.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Which is a tactic I think the pharmaceutical companies use because they have basically unlimited budget for legal work. So if they can drain your bank account and you have to quit, then they're good.
Yeah, that's right. So the one positive, well, I guess there's more than one because we eventually succeeded, but the fact that they do cover the cost of litigation is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And
it seems to me that based on what you said earlier, that we know that they're undercompensating because, assuming that adverse reactions to HPV are possible, and I think even the most fervent advocates of the vaccine would admit, you know, quietly that yes, adverse effects are possible. There's nothing that excludes adverse effects if you, for example, have another vaccine at about the same time, or if you're on a drug which plausibly has a similar side effect, or if you've had some minor heart problems monitored at some time in the past. And yet in all of those cases, vaccine compensation will be denied, which means that they must be undercompensating. There must be cases that if we were God and could really know what was going on, we would know that certain cases had been caused by the vaccines, but because of these interfering factors, compensation is being denied.
Yes. Very few actually get compensated. And the compensation is pretty minimal. It's not like where you would have a jury and they would decide the amount of compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Not capped if you have an injury. And then if you did win an award, it would be based on the kind of injury and any expenses you may have into the future. With a death, it's capped at $250,000.
And I would think that in many cases, in many cases of a death, another factor would be the family saying, well, you know, we've lost our daughter, we've lost our son, whoever we've lost, they're not coming back with this money. I mean, what was the main motivation for you to pursue this to the bitter end?
Yes. There are usually opportunities where they'll offer you a settlement,
mm-hmm.
To just drop, end the case. And that could have made it shorter for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not settle because I wanted them to admit or to acknowledge that the vaccine caused her death. And
which they did in the most weaselly way possible. Like, if I can quote from the report, it says, while the secretary's experts, that's the experts for the government, Dr. Phillips and Dr. Yeager, presented several reasons why the theory was unlikely to be probable. That's the theory that the molecular mimicry caused by the vaccine caused the arrhythmia, which caused the death. The secretary does not argue that the theory is impossible. So the secretary is not saying that the theory is possible or probable. They're just saying it's not impossible.
Yeah, and you have to bear in mind that that is the way the special master is framing it.
Right.
And he, even in his revised ruling, has many errors. So he's framing it in a way that would be different if he didn't seem to be trying to protect himself and the industry, to be frank.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It seems like it's written so that if somebody was to stand up and say that in this case the government admitted that HPV caused the death of Christina, they could say, no, we just argued that it was a slim possibility, therefore we, in our incredible generosity, we compensated it.
Let me just say that we met all the criteria required
right.
by law. And he doesn't want to say that.
No, he did not say that.
So he's, and the fact that he quoted the government's attorneys rather than quoting our experts and the government experts, he tried to reframe the outcome. But the fact is, we met our burden of proof by preponderant evidence, which is, which is the maximum required by law for this program.
If you had not met the three requirements, he would have denied it.
Absolutely.
And he doesn't say that. It's also interesting, I think he, maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but he says, increased amounts of intracellular calcium can lead to arrhythmia, and then he cites Dr. Yeager, who's the government's expert, and arrhythmia can be caused by autoantibodies, and he again cites Dr. Yeager. I mean, did Dr. Yeager admit that increased calcium and increased intracellular calcium and autoantibodies can cause arrhythmia?
He agreed with our experts that it could.
Okay.
He didn't quote our experts and their explanation. He quoted
government. In a way, it's more powerful if he quotes the government's experts because they are, they're not supposed to be, but expert witnesses often reflect the people paying their salaries. So the fact that a government expert would agree with those things, I think, is more powerful than if an expert you had sourced agreed with them.
Yes, the final outcome was experts on both sides had to agree we met our burden of proof.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
I should also mention that before all of this, I want to just go back for anyone who's considering the vaccine. A couple of things. You have to consider what I later found out, that first of all, there's no evidence the vaccine even prevents cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the whole promotion, the whole reason we agreed to it. We already have safe and effective ways to prevent cervical cancer. It was also presented to us at a time when it sounded they were advertising this vaccine like there was some pandemic about cervical cancer in young
right.
women. There isn't. The incidence is so, it's like less than 1%.
Yes, it is a relatively rare cancer, and I understand the rate in the United States has been slowly declining. But of course, they would say, well, even one girl who dies of cervical cancer is too many, but they don't turn around and say, but even one girl who dies of an adverse event due to the vaccination is also unacceptable.
Right, and the thing is that the girls, this is a disease, if it does strike someone, will be in middle age.
Right.
You know, like average age on something like 49 to 50, and it's treatable. If you get pap screens and they find irregular cells, they follow you, and there's an appropriate intervention. A doctor, a gynecologist, Dr. Rosenstein, was on TV around the time the ads were, and he said, a young woman who avails herself of regular pap screening with appropriate follow-up will never, ever develop cervical cancer.
But what's going to stand in the way of billions of dollars of profits on the vaccine?
He was off the air.
Yes. Well, that's definitely not a good career move to criticize a major new vaccine. I remember the time when they managed to persuade Rick Perry in Texas, you know, a right-wing politician, that Gardasil should be mandatory. I guess there was a big pushback against that, but I'm sure there was a lot of lobbying behind the scenes because they just want to sell more of the vaccine. Where did you get support? I'm going to guess that there wasn't too much support from politicians or the media. Did you get support from anywhere outside your family and your lawyer?
Oh, yes. Back when Gardasil was first introduced, and it had only been licensed in its second year when Chris died, there were a number of news agencies that really were following stories of adverse reactions. So I did have support there, some radio shows, mm-hmm. TV interview. But more importantly, it was this network of moms online and, we were the support for each other. But then that began to coalesce into groups like SaneVax. Gary Null
mm-hmm.
Did a video. And we thought in the beginning that the publicity, the awareness, and I wrote letters to the CDC and the FDA,
right.
And we thought if we just made them aware that they would take action. And
yes.
It was so naive.
Sadly, it is when you recognize that these government agencies are not representing you, but they're representing the interests of the pharmaceutical companies, just like agricultural agencies represent the fertilizer, seed, and pesticide manufacturers and not the farmers.
Right. Yes. And they are getting royalties on the sale of the vaccine. I mean, that is just mind-blowing.
Who is getting royalties? The CDC?
The National Institute of Health, Department of Health and Human Services. They discovered the process, National Institute of Health, or NIH, discovered the process by which they could manufacture the HPV vaccine, and they gave the patent to Merck. And they get royalties on the sale, and the scientists who were involved in that discovery of that process of the virus-like particles, they also get monies from their contribution. So it's just this. There's no objective investigator in the process.
Yes, everybody who has any power has a conflict of interest, it seems. And
yeah.
It seems like the purpose of the vaccine court is to just put the brakes on compensation so that while it can happen, it doesn't occur in the public light, and it doesn't occur frequently enough that people are going to say there's a big problem with vaccinations. We're running out of time. This has been a very fruitful conversation. But perhaps two last questions. How have your attitudes towards vaccines in general changed, and what would your advice be to people maybe considering the HPV vaccine for themselves or for their daughters?
Right. Well, my feeling about vaccines, I would say, first of all, my daughter was vaccinated with all of the the childhood vaccines.
Mm.
I had never questioned them.
Right.
And this experience has opened my eyes. It's her gift to me is awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see that it's an industry, that they are not, there's no independent investigator. They're not doing the kind of pre-licensure trials to test for safety that they should be doing.
Right.
And I have come into contact with other parents with other vaccine issues, and I know now that the system is not working in our best interest. So I am suspect now of all vaccines, but particularly Gardasil that I know in depth,
mm-hmm.
is not safe and effective and necessary as they claim. And then your second question about what parents should do, what families should do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Keep vigilant about maintaining your ability to decide to make a choice about being vaccinated or not.
Mm-hmm.
There's tremendous pressure to take away your right to choose.
Right.
And the second thing is, you are powerful. You can decline. You can currently decline, in most states, can decline the HPV vaccine. And you should investigate for yourself. And do not be pressured into buying into false information. Do not be pressured into getting it, thinking that you've got some kind of protection for your child. And the more people who decline, the reason they're increasing push for sales is because sales are down because there are so many injuries and deaths. And people know that this is not a safe and effective vaccine.
Yeah, I'm sure that everybody who was close to your family learned about what happened to Christina, and as time went on, probably a lot of them started to have second thoughts about HPV and other vaccines just because of the horrible circumstances that you experienced. So yeah, there definitely seems to be a push. I know that at the time of that little measles outbreak at Disneyland a few years ago, the Toronto Star published an article on the girls who had whose health had become severely disrupted after HPV vaccination, and the newspaper said, we're not drawing any connections here, we're not saying that it was causative, and the paper was forced to withdraw that article, which I think was the end of mainstream media criticizing or raising questions about the HPV vaccines.
Yeah, Katie Couric had also interviewed me and a mom whose daughter didn't get vaccinated, as well as a pediatrician and an expert. And she did a very balanced session on TV with about Gardasil, and she was off the air a month later.
Yes, that's true. That happens to the media. It happens often to doctors who go against the mainstream paradigms as well.
Right.
Anyway, I think it's unfortunately have to wrap up. I think we could talk another hour, but I think it is wonderful that you've turned your energy to trying to help other people. Your loss cannot be compensated for, but you can help other people avoid the same situation.
Well, thank you, and thank you, because it's so important for people to know and to be able to make informed decisions. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to episode 178 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com, that's /infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you for listening, and goodbye.